relish. And I mean, patients could hardly believe it. There's one story that patients came to meet him because he was going to be operating on their son, and said, "Oh yeah, Dr. Cohn will be right there." And in comes this kind of burly figure with his sleeves rolled up and grease all up his forearms, and he said, "Hello, I'm Dr. Cohn." And he said, "No, you're not. No, you're not." He had been greasing up. He had been cleaning a ventilation shaft that needed cleaning, at like dawn. And so he showed up looking like, you know, a handyman. And they "We're going to wait here for Dr. Cohn." So that is Dr. Cohn. Believe us, that's Dr. Cohn.
There's a word in the subtitle, betrayal. And as a reader, I have to say that I felt what happened between these men was a betrayal of a really deep sort. With lovers, the old saw is that one person always holds the upper hand and one needs the other, needs more than the other. But here we have a friendship that was also so entangled with both of their obsession, the life's work and a calling, that it feels more out of whack what happened between them. And I couldn't help, you know, you do a good job of presenting Wilder Penfield's strengths, but I couldn't help presenting his obliviousness to the depth of his friend's love. And you know, how did you? I have a feeling that you had a particular love for Cohn as well.
Mm-hmm.
And can you just touch on how that friendship really started to crack?
Yeah. Should we be coy? But
I don't know. I'm trying to, like, I really want you to. We don't want
okay,
to give.
No spoilers.
You know what?
No
we
spoilers.
Won't. We won't give away. There's a really beautiful thing that Eric has untangled around how Cohn died, and you know what may have been in Cohn's psychology and so on. So we won't go there because you really have to read this book. But we can talk about Penfield just being cold.
Yeah,
around.
Before the crisis,
yeah.
These things were building up. That,
it's hard to have spoilers in a work of history, but there are. There is kind of a spoiler. So I'm sorry.
No, I think I never know how to handle that because that's right. It is history and it's sort of on the record, but a lot of what happened I sort of uncovered. So
yeah.
Cohn wanted the Institute to be a two-man operation. He was never happier than when he was in Penfield's company. And, there's photos of them, and you can tell Cohn's looking up at him just adoringly. And you can understand why. Penfield was incredibly charismatic. He had taught Cohn everything he knew. They were, they would spend Christmases together. Penfield's kids called Cohn Uncle Bill. You know, they were very entwined in each other's lives. But for Penfield, the Institute always came first. And, you know, quite naturally, it grew from its origins as essentially a two-man operation. Penfield had a real knack for recruiting talent and brought in all these brilliant figures who made it this incredible multidisciplinary shop where psychology and psychiatry even and these early brain visualization technology were all working together and overlapping and informing each other. Neurochemistry, Penfield coined that term, neurochemistry, and employed one of the first full-on neurochemists who learned a lot about the sort of soup of chemicals in our brain. And it became this sort of dream team of brilliant specialists. Donald Hebb, who has biographies written of him in his own right, was an early neuropsychology fellow under Penfield and would do these psychological tests to ensure that patients weren't being left with deficits as a result of surgery. But Cohn, and this is recorded in Penfield's diaries, that he he had observed that Combs unhappy with this, the way in which these new recruits took away from his time with Penfield, essentially, and from the primacy of their partnership. His happiest years were those, the first 6 or 7 years in Montreal, when they were at the Royal Victoria Hospital and hadn't yet founded the Institute, which by needs had to have this bigger staff. And so Penfield did notice this, and you know, other people remarked on just how keen Cone was always to be with Penfield. I mean, when Penfield was recruited solo to Montreal, Cone wasn't initially part of the deal, but Penfield said, "I won't come unless you hire Cone as well." Then half the neurosurgery departments in the U.S. tried to hire Cone instead. This guy might be a free agent. We're gonna hire him. I mean, there was this hiring frenzy. Philadelphia, Chicago, New York. People were throwing offers at him, and he turned them all down to be with Penfield. And people were
including a lot more money as well.
Yeah, a lot more money and master of his own house. And someone said, "I've never seen a man turn down such opportunities." And people were a little disquieted almost. But why is Cone? I mean, it was just not done. But he, for him, it was all about the partnership. And so, you know, Penfield was aware of this, but didn't. He had a knack for balance in his life, Penfield. He had. And I do admire this about him, and I hope it comes through in the book that, you know, Anne's right that I do have a special love for Cone, and I think he's the hero of the book, but he's not someone you'd want to emulate necessarily. He was an extremist. He was obsessive, and everything he went after, whether it was his approach to neurosurgery, his treatment of patients, or his feelings about Penfield, he was all in. And Penfield had ambitions and could channel them and could work toward goals, but he also had this wonderful gift for building a life, and he had a country place on Lake Memphremagog. It was beautiful. It was 200 acres. He had luck too. He had the bad luck to be on a transport ship that was U-boated during World War I and broke his leg, but he had the good luck to get $30,000 in compensation payment for it after the war, which he took and bought this, at the time, very cheap farm on Lake Memphremagog. Became this family compound that it is still in the Penfield family today. Things just sort of worked out for him. And, you know, he sailed and skied and wrote novels and traveled around the world with his wife, and he had 4 kids, and they had a cook and a nanny, and he had an opera cloak and he went out to soirees, and he was just he was a very dedicated doctor and a brilliant scientist, but he had a sense of perspective and balance in life. And so Cone, he couldn't pay as much attention to Cone as Cone paid to him, and couldn't put as much, you know, I guess we'd now say emotional labor into the relationship as Cone was willing to. It's a neologism that they would not have recognized. But that was it. I mean, he didn't have the bandwidth to also use a very contemporary expression to tend to Cone's moods. He, you know, we haven't really touched on this, but Cone suffered from mental illness throughout his adult life. Yeah, depression. I think people have suggested he may have had bipolar disorder, because he could work in these manias for even months at a time of 18-hour days and endless get up and go and pep in his step, and then he would crash. You know, although they were best of friends and wrote each other these pining letters and acted like brothers in some ways, Penfield was not there for Cone. I mean, I think this is also a generational thing. You know, this was not necessarily expected of friends. at the time that they would be there for each other, particularly male friends. So, Cohen felt neglected by Penfield increasingly over the years.
And also edged out of the running of the Institute, right?
Yeah, that's right. Are we going to get into this?
Well, I think maybe we should move to questions.
But yes, there became tension over who would succeed Penfield. And I think we better leave it at that. But there were questions about whether Cohen would be a fitting successor. He was probably the greatest neurosurgeon in the world, the most compassionate doctor many people had ever met. He knew the Institute inside and out. But a lot of a director's job was raising money.
Schmoozing.
Which Cohen left his own 60th birthday party early. So to say that he didn't care for schmoozing would be an understatement. He would have his residents over for dinner, ostensibly as a sort of goodwill gesture or whatever, but he would, immediately after bringing them home, he would go have a nap on his favorite chair, and they would make conversation with his long-suffering wife, Avis, who turns out a graduate student, McGill, actually, just when she's writing a paper about Penfield and Cohen's wives.
Oh, wow.
Which I'm dying to read, because I don't do them full justice in the book. They appear, but in any case, long-suffering Avis would have these conversations, and then they would have dinner, he would carve the roast or sit down and sort of scarf his food, and it's like, come along, Gordon, or come along, Bill, or whatever, and throw them back into his shiny black sedan and drive back to the Institute. So that was his idea of socializing, you know.
Yeah.
So he had blind spots as a potential leader of the Institute, and you know he was so bad at getting donors excited about the research he was doing. You see it in his correspondence. He said, "This will be 3 years of dreary, boring groundwork. Please enclose check for $30,000. And you know, Penfield would you know, gloss his appeals with, yeah. And it was brilliant, and it was all right. He wasn't exaggerating. He said, we're mapping the brain just like the astronauts are beginning to map the cosmos. But isn't the mind of man that much greater than the stars in the sky? You know, he was quite a gifted writer. His novels are really bad. I don't recommend reading them. But his he had a way with words. He would have Shakespearean epigraphs on his scientific papers. Like, no one does this. No one did it then either. He could quote the Bible chapter and verse. So he was brilliant at getting the world excited about the work that was happening with De Niro, and that was an essential part of being director. This is all building to a head in the mid-50s as the Institute is achieving its kind of greatest glory, and is a sort of United Nations of young brilliant scientists from all over the world, and but meanwhile the bedrock of the place, this relationship between these two men, is starting to erode.
Should we have some questions? Does anybody have questions? Are you going to bring a mic? Yeah, okay. There's going to be a mic. We could go on and on, unfortunately. And we've been enjoying not to go on and on.
Mine isn't really a question, but I just want to say the book is fabulous.
Oh, thank you. My favorite kind of question. Anyone else have similar questions?
More.
Partly because I did my nursing training at the Royal Victoria Hospital.
Are you kidding me?
And I spent some time at the neuro.
Oh, no kidding.
And I knew, you know, Wilder Penfield was blah, blah, but I didn't really know until I read your book. So, and not only the sort of scientific medical side, but just what was going on in Montreal at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, thank you. It's well worth reading, everybody.
You'll get your 10 bucks later.
Do I actually have a couple?
couple of questions.
Yeah.
One of them has to do with, so you had your theme right at the very beginning. You knew that you were writing about the relationship between these two men. I was wondering if you ran into any sort of surprises or research that took you in a different direction that you didn't think you were going to.
Uh-huh.
That's one. And the other one I was wondering about was the fact-checking and the editing process.
Uh-huh.
Did you find that you had made a lot of mistakes, or did you find...
that's a great question.
Did
it's
you find great. People corrected things that you thought were correct?
Yeah. No, those are great questions, and they actually give me the chance to give due credit to the people who were instrumental in shaping the book. So the first is my agent at Cook McDermott, Martha Webb, I think in my origin story of the book, I did gloss over this because it started getting into the weeds a little bit, but my initial proposal was actually less about Conan Penfield. They were part of the story, but not the ribbon running through the whole book. It was initially conceived more as a history of the Nero, and how it was going to be called the Montreal Mind or something like that. How Montreal invented the brain, you know, whatever. And you could write that book because there are these fascinating bits of research that get short shrift in the book that would have had whole chapters to themselves or whatever. But of course, Martha said this isn't quite human enough, right? There's a series of great character sketches, you know, and all these big scientists were characters and eccentrics and etc. But she didn't say, I think this needs to be Conan Penfield all the way through, but just the word human, you know. And I sort of went back to the drawing board and realized what I care most about in this story is Cone, and to understand what happens to Cone, you have to understand his relationship with Penfield. And it emerged as I was working through that theme and their relationship to the science. And there is this sort of sad irony that I nonetheless found very resonant and compelling, that these two mind mappers, who were the world's greatest explorers of the human brain as such, were hopelessly at sea when it came to each other's minds, right? They were better at the brain in general. So it made that centrality of their relationship, you know, work on so many levels, I thought, thematically, and of course as a on the level of storytelling as well. In terms of the fact checking and editing, the book was edited by a woman named Sarah St. Pierre at Random House, who total stroke of luck that she got her hands on the manuscript, because the editor who acquired the book later left the company, and before the editing process had begun, fortunately, so I wasn't switching horses midstream, but Sarah came on. I knew nothing about her, and she is about my age and a bit young, but she was a total wizard, and was always really insistent on the story. Let's move this forward. This what happens next? And you know, I'm a newspaper reporter, and you know, we say we write stories. That's the jargon for it. But they're really often not stories. It's chunks of information. You know, sometimes with an anecdote or two thrown in there. But a 95,000 word story is a very different beast than just keeping the ball rolling through 300 pages. With something that I didn't quite pull off in the manuscript, I think, and Sarah got me there. So that was the editing in terms of, you know, sort of literary editing. The fact checking, my biggest kind of fail safe was that there's a neurosurgeon in Toronto named Nir Lipsman, who I had gotten in touch with because I wrote a piece about Cone before the book. 3 or 4 years before the book, it was kind of the germ of the book, and he was very touched by it and had it resonated with him, and realizing I have to give away spoilers to explain why, but we struck up a correspondence, and ultimately I sent him the manuscript as a kind of expert reader. And, you know, he is not an expert on the history of the Nero per se, but I wanted him to make sure I didn't, you know, get the hemispheres wrong, you know. I wasn't taking out the wrong part of the brain on the page. And, you know, he had some notes, and, you know, it's the A goes before the I in brain, I know, but it was like, he caught some technical things, but less than I feared, and I was, you know, it would have been fine if he had caught a million things, because that's what he was there for, and I would have fixed them, but I did my reportorial due diligence, and really, you know, I have no scientific background, so it was especially important for me to get his eyes on the thing, because it was my greatest fear that, you know, make a mistake that would make a neuroscientifically literate reader dismiss the whole thing as a result, and I think I avoided that. So, you know, then I did my own fact-checking of just, you know, making sure names are spelled right, and the same way I do with all my stories in the Globe, but for 300 pages, so that... And I finished the manuscript 2 weeks before my twins were born.
Thank God you weren't doing the fact-checking after the twins were born.
No, I was.
Oh!
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. I thought, oh, I finished the book before the twins were born. I was so proud of myself. That was my deadline all along, and I did it. And but a manuscript does not a book make. You know, there's a lot. There's a lot more cooking time. So, there were some heroic grandparents who were involved there.
Thank God.
A lot of, yeah.
Yeah.
Closed doors and sort of doing this on my bed with my legs crossed while I'm trying to tune out my kids in the next room. I think it's, you know, in any 300 page book, I'm sure there's the odd groaner in there, probably, but I was pretty careful.
I just wanted to thank you very much for writing this book. My mother was an OR nurse who trained at the Neuro in the 1940s.
Oh!
So
wow.
I have childhood memories of her telling stories about Dr. Penfield. I have no memory of her talking about Dr. Cohn, so I'm really excited about reading the book.
Oh, that's so cool. What was her name?
Isabel Miller.
Huh. There's an amazing...
She was a nurse who had graduated from Sherbrooke.
Okay.
From a farming family in the Eastern Townships. And in fact, one of her brothers had a farming accident, and I believe his back was operated on, if not by Dr. Cohn, at least he was involved.
It would have been Cohn.
If
it was the back, it would have been Cohn.
Anyhow,
that's amazing.
So, a cousin of mine is right now doing some family history research, and so we unearthed some of my mother's letters later on, and she mentions both doctors, but not in great detail.
Wow.
So, yeah, I'm interested to read and see if it'll jog my mind. I know I remember the Bertho story and other stories about the superstar, but not the quieter.
Well, the nurses were the other... big unsung hero of the Nero, and that there's a lot of specialized nursing that needs to be done with neurological patients, and a lot of just literally backbreaking work. I mean, that Cohn was so fastidious about bed sores, which are a common source of infection, and the nurses would have to turn paraplegic patients every hour on the hour, which is much more common than in most hospitals, and, you know, these like sometimes 200 pound patients without, you know, any ability to move themselves, and so it was they were often underappreciated, not by Cohn, but I'm sure your mother did just exemplary work.
Obsessed about bed sores.
yeah, that was a Cohn thing. He was obsessed with bed sores. It's just the last thing is funny that your mother's remembered or told stories about Penfield and Ocon. Penfield was so famous. I mean, McLean's declared him the greatest living Canadian. He has this road named after him in Montreal. His face was on stamps. That even people, I came across a family of a patient who had been operated on Cone, it turned out, but I uncovered that in the archives. They had always thought it was Penfield, because that's how it entered family lore. It was just kind of more interesting that way. Like, Dad was operated on by Dr. Penfield. That had more of an aura. And, you know, there's something really kind of sad with that, because often, Cone, you know, I have to do the math, he did something like 3 times as much surgery as Penfield. Far more patients actually passed through his hands than, but it didn't have the same cachet to say, oh, I was operated on by Dr. Cone.
Same thing, we have some special guests over here.
Oh. Now, I worked as an x-ray technologist from 54 to 56.
Oh.
Yeah. 54 to 56. So, I was disappointed that you didn't mention the x-ray department. What was on every floor, but you didn't mention us.
Oh no.
It was at the back of the building, so we had a good view of the football field.
Right.
Either to see the games or to see the first helicopter landing.
Yes.
Yes, so that was a big event.
Was now, Ed Child still?
Well, I didn't realize he was a child. I couldn't remember. It's a long time ago.
Oh no, I mean Ed Child with an E. Edward Child was was the first head of neuroradiology at the institute, but
was a McRae.
Okay. Oh yeah, yeah. That name rings a bell. Yeah.
Dr. Penfield was a very pleasant person to meet. Say in the elevator, he would pass the time of day. But Dr. Cone was very hard to please.
Oh.
We did mainly his back surgeries, of course.
Yes.
And of course, you said he didn't like skiing. Well, his residents were not supposed to ski.
Yeah.
But one did, and
yes,
broke his leg.
Yes.
So you can imagine that he had Dr. Cone making a very hard time.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned at the end that a Dr. McDonald left Montreal because he didn't know French.
Yes.
He went to Vancouver.
Yes.
Well, many years later, I was living in Vancouver, and I was sent to him for a back problem.
Gordon Thompson?
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes.
I interviewed him.
Yeah.
Now, he passed away a couple of years ago, but what a small world. Yeah, he was one of Cone's chief residents and saw Cone as a father figure and so on.
And we have residents from all over the world, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. June Wada there?
I didn't know that name, no. Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, I found you during my research.
Yeah. mentioned the x-ray department.
I'll have to interview you for the second edition.
Okay, so we got time for one more question, I think.
Hi. Obviously, room for a sequel, this one I'm This is really fascinating. I can't wait to read it. I've been researching a nursing student around that same time, and I threw her into the psychiatric hospital here in Kingston. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, as you're talking about the neurological hospital, what was the position about lobotomies and those horrible eye lobotomies, that were very popular? Was it Dr. Friedman who did the whole bunch of those eye lobotomies? He used to do them in his office.
Ice pick Friedman.
Yeah, he did them in the back of his car and everything. So I was thinking about that with regard to the fellow who was so keen on hygiene.
Yes. So this is a great opportunity to give Anne Collins your due in the making of this book. So as we heard in the introduction, Anne wrote this Governor General's award-winning book called In the Sleep Room about Dr. Ewan Cameron, who ran the Allen Memorial Institute, which was literally next door to the Neuro. And so he was, you know, a capsule history that Anne can correct me on, but he was a psychiatrist who founded this institute in which he had some progressive ideas. He wouldn't lock the door of the hospital and so on, but he would also perform what we now think of as torture, various forms.
Brainwashing,
yeah. He would drug patients to sleep for a month at a time and play tapes in their ear in the hopes of wiping their personalities clean so they could be built up from scratch. But he would wipe their personalities clean, but wasn't able to build them up. And just ruined all hundreds of lives. And as it turns out, he was being funded without his knowledge, I think, by the CIA.
Well, that's up in the air.
That's up in the air, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
it was part of the CIA's brainwashing research program. And this was all going on
next door,
contemporaneously next door to Conan Penfield. Penfield had actually tried to recruit Cameron to bring his psychiatry program within the walls of the Neuro. And Cameron, who wanted to win the Nobel Prize more than anything, and what was
arguably a bigger ego than
Penfield, even.
And less talented.
Yeah, less empathetic in many ways. But he refused, and it was a stroke of great luck for the Neuro because he would have tainted it with his kind of awfulness. But he did actually lead Penfield into temptation on lobotomies. I can't take credit for this discovery. There's a PhD student named Yvonne Percassian, who actually has a book about the Neuro coming out in January, who discovered that Cameron and Penfield performed, they weren't full lobotomies in the sense of removing an entire lobe of the brain. He called them gyrectomies. He would remove gyri or folds in the brain, but on psychiatric patients who suffer from schizophrenia and other conditions. Penfield had always been dead set against lobotomies because of his experience with his sister Ruth. And so it was a really strange departure for him to experiment with this. But it had become really common practice by the 1940s when he was doing this, and it was seen as this new frontier. And, you know, there was no effective treatment for psychiatric illness at the time. So he performed a handful. He was disappointed with the results that he saw. So that lobotomies, as such, were not performed at the Neuro. And it's to Penfield and Cohn's enormous credit because it was the darkest chapter of neurosurgery at the time.
Yeah. And I think
that's a good.
We're getting played off like at the Oscars, right?
Thank you, Anne and Eric, for an exceptionally stimulating and afternoon, and I'm sure this will be talked about for a long time.
Yeah.
And Eric will be out in the lobby to sign books after this, and if you have your books, please bring them to him. And if you don't have the book and you want it, the Oscar and the book, the novel Idea of Book People are in the festival book room, just the opposite. Just go. You all know where it is?
Yeah. Okay. He's getting tired.
Yeah, it's been a long day. We want to know about your experience and how much you enjoyed it here, so please log on to our website, kingstonwritersfest.ca, and tell us how we're doing. And as I said, please join Eric in the foyer to get your book signed. And above all, enjoy the rest of the festival. See you tomorrow.
And you just heard from an as yet on this show unaired event from a September 20th, 2025 Kingston Writers Fest event called The Mind Mappers. You heard a conversation between Ann Collins and author Eric Andrew G. This roughly 90-minute conversation began right at the top of the 4 o'clock hour. It is now 5:34, and you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM, streaming live every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock at www.cfrc.ca. And again, the reminder that I usually do at the end of the hour, and it's to let you know that I upload both hours of this show every week to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on CFRCFM.wordpress.com, and they do remain there for 3 years. I usually try to get that done by 7 o'clock after I get home from the show. Short mention, I did this at the very start of the first hour, I'll just be brief here. I recorded 10 events at the Kings and Writers Fest last year. Today was the 9th one I've aired. I do have one more to air, but I'm bringing in something else next week. So that final one will most likely air the first week in April, the first Friday in April. Before we move on, I'd like to extend my heartfelt thanks to all of you out there for tuning in to the first hour and a half plus of this show, and an equal thanks to Kingston Writers Fest, their staff and volunteers, and to Ann and Eric for what was a wonderful conversation. And as mentioned, I do look forward to bringing that final event in a couple of weeks. You know what? Before we move on, I've got some things outside of this that I'm going to do before we move into the last portion where I will share some information about upcoming events here and around Kingston or even farther away from Kingston and calls for submissions. But let's go ahead and do this first, and when I come back, we'll do that then. How's that? Here we go.
Folk Everything is your passport to the finest in folk music. Old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, he won't bother you. He's a busy man, he's got things to do.
It's all here Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Folk Everything with Hugh on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
Hello and welcome to Salt Licht in Rapture. I'm your host, Nishan Tung. Salt Licht in Rapture is a sonic exploration of, to quote Virginia Woolf, violent waves of emotion. Featuring both known and lesser known musicians and poets, a special emphasis is placed on oddball, enigmatic, outsider artists whose work invokes dreamscapes and feelings of alienation, nostalgia, melancholy, existential unease, and yearning. Join me on Fridays at 8 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Your library, your story. At the Kingston Frontenac Public Library, books are just the beginning. A library card starts a lifelong adventure, connecting you to everything you need to inspire learning, creativity, and fun. With 16 locations and plenty of online services, using your library has never been easier. Study in a quiet space, meet friends and learn new things, or explore the world through a magazine or a museum pass. Become a part of our story. Visit your local library branch or find us online at kfpl.ca.
Get round and free.
when you're down and out, when you're on the street, when evening falls so hard, I will comfort you. I'll take your part. Oh, when darkness comes and pain is all around, like a bridge over trouble.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC. Listen. Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Greetings, loved ones. This is DJ Nasty Nexus coming to you live and direct from CFRC 101.9. I'm here to bring you the goods from my new show, Classless Radio, airing every Friday night at 11 p.m. I'll be giving you hits and hidden gems all the way from jazz to blues and hip-hop and R&B. Music from the soul that everybody needs. Hop on my wavelengths and get right with the kid to kick off your big weekend. Stay tuned. I try my best just to be a
man. And again, you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And sandwiched between some of those messages you heard, and get my notes here, This was actually from Simon and Garfunkel's. I took this off of, I have a copy of this, actually, and so it's my own copy. It's Simon and Garfunkel's Greatest Hits, released in 1972. This track, Bridge Over Troubled Water, was recorded live at Carnegie Hall, New York, in July of 1970. And, yeah. It was kind of nice to revisit that today. I thought about it, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to air that on the show. So for the remainder of the show, I'll be sharing some information, some events, and if we get to them, a few calls for submissions. So let's just start that. I do have one song to take us out at the very end of the hour, too, so I hope you can stick around for all of this. There's only 14 minutes left of this show. There are two events happening actually tomorrow evening. One of them is here in Kingston, and it's a new Kingston West End monthly poetry series, and it's organized and hosted by Liz Huntley Jentsch, the founder of the series. And she describes it this way. She says, "Join us at the Grains and Goods Coffee Bar Studio 330 West End Wellness for an evening of poetry and connection and damn good coffee." So there you go. I was at the first one last month, and she's going to feature Jane McDonald, Joseph Elliott, and herself, and also a play excerpt by Larry Scanlon. That should be great. Should be a lot of, it should be very, very wonderful. It's going to be held at Grains and Goods Coffee Bar. This is very close to the CAT Center. You could actually park in the CAT Center if you can't find parking, and walk over across the street, basically, to the, I'm guessing, west. Yeah, and it's at, the location is, so again, Grains and Goods Coffee Bar / Studio 330 West. It's 851 and 855 Norwest Road in Kingston. Doors do open at 6:30, and again tomorrow evening, Saturday, March 21st, from 7 to 9 p.m. Now, outside of Kingston, there is another event that's a monthly event called Night Kitchen 2. They do have a Facebook presence, too, so you can get information there as well, and also other directions. It always features around a dozen performers each month. I'm just going to read from their thing. It says, "Night Kitchen 2 provides a showcase for a diverse group of performers who present their music, poetry, or spoken word on the stage at the Pinnacle Playhouse in Belleville. Night Kitchen 2 is a not-for-profit project. Their live shows, again, host about a dozen performers. And this month, there will be two features, and I'll be reading there this weekend as well. So, and there's also a featured musician, Deb Palmer. So there are going to be about 12 of us. I read there in 2019, and I had a wonderful time. So I'm really looking forward to it. It says Night Kitchen 2 is in, Nathan Mahaffey and Alexandra Bell co-host the event. Night Kitchen 2 is in its 11th season and is produced by Gary Magwood, Marvin Tucker, Alexandra Bell, and Nathan Mahaffey. Again, this is at the Belleville Theater Guild at Pinnacle Playhouse, which is located at 256 Pinnacle Street, Belleville. And doors open at 6:45, runs from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. again tomorrow night. Coming up on Monday night, a Zoom event, and I've attended one of these on Zoom as well. This one's in Montreal, so I'm kind of jumping around all over the place here. Jan Jorgensen founded the Lawn Chair Series in January 2006 and returned recently with the soirees will be, and the soirees will be held from 7 to 8:30 online. And I believe it's always the fourth Monday of the month, but this one is coming up this coming Monday. And it's going to feature a friend of mine, an incredible poet, Carolyn Vandermeer, and Matthew Retineau. And I'm sorry, I don't know a lot about him, but yeah, I do really love Carolyn's work. And it will be held again 7 to 8:30 online. And if you go to their Facebook page, you can also get all the information. But it's at, trying to find the right one. There's also a website, but you can find that on there, the directions for that. But it's www.lawnchairsoiree.org/next-event. And should be able to find it. Then I don't know if I mentioned that there is an open mic. You get like 3 or 4 minutes, something like that, for the open mic. Happening Monday, March 23rd, 7 to 8:30 p.m. Then coming up on Tuesday night here, back here in Kingston again, another monthly series called Quirks of Human Nature. Meg Freer and Deb Sherman's organize and host, co-host the event this month. It will feature poet Arena Moga. Music is Jen LeClaire. Bonus poets Laylee Jamali, Leanne Terrace, and Don Sadler. Deb Sherman's will be also on a piano and also co-host. And trying to see, this coming Thursday, I will mention this just as, because this will probably be the last event I have time to share. There is going to be a ton of book launches happening at Novel Idea this summer, the rest of this season into spring and even a bit into summer. So you're going to be hearing a lot of book launch events on this show because I try to record them, as many of them as I can. The creative writing group at Queens, grad students at Queens University did this 2 years ago. They couldn't last year for just some reasons that prevented it, but they're back after that inaugural event 2 years ago. I think they'd like to do it again annually, but they are doing it this coming Thursday, March 26th, 7 p.m., Novel Idea Bookstore, 156 Princess Street here in Kingston. And go to Novel Ideas, really touting Facebook here, but go to their Facebook page because they usually do a really great job of promoting and informing on that page, especially the week of the event. So there should be something on there already. If there isn't, there will be by Monday. So anyway, I suppose what I should start to do is kind of clearing out, because I do want to play that song and I want to introduce it. But again, you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice. My name is Bruce, here every Friday afternoon to 4 to 6. We do stream live online at www.cfrc.ca. It is quickly approaching 54 minutes after 5 o'clock. Don't forget, I think this might be my third mention, but I just feel like I need to do it. Just a reminder that every week I upload both hours of this show to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. They do remain there for 3 years, and I usually get those uploaded just before or right around 7 p.m. After the show airs. So also coming up right at the top of the hour, 2 hours of East Coast music in a show called Saltwater Music. That's hosted by Rob Carnell. Again, that's coming up at the top of the hour. As I mentioned earlier, I won't be playing a Kingston Writers Fest event next week, but what I will be playing is the March and the Journey Continues open mic reading event here in Kingston. So that's what you have to look forward to next week. I'm going to play off of one of my favorite cuts, and there are so many, but Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here album, their 1975 album, And here's the title track off it. Here you go. Have a great week.
Wish you were here.